Last week, in the course of giving the talk, I mentioned my view that one of the epidemic illnesses in our society is people who are overly busy. I think it's a contagious illness because a lot of people have caught it. And I like to use the word contagious because I think there's a lot of social pressure or social context for all of us adopting sometimes an overly busy lifestyle. And I wanted to spend some more time talking about that. And my impression was that it resonated with a lot of people here when I mentioned it last week. And so I'll talk about it some more. And as I talk about it, I'm very aware that this is a Dharma talk for myself also. So I have some experience of this. And as I start this talk, I'd like to give you a kind of an image or kind of an idea for you to kind of reflect on, perhaps, as you listen to the rest of the talk. And that is that sometimes when I'm at my best and I notice that I'm getting overly busy or overly, not really overly busy, but feeling overly, like I feel like I don't have enough time to take care of all the things I have to take care of, that kind of busy, and a little bit oppressed by time and, oh, I have to get this done, that one of the best things I found to do is to stop and to sit, to meditate. Now, you'd think that that's the last thing you want to do because that takes time, and the precious time you're supposed to get, you know, you could be getting a number of things done. And every time that I do that, I found that afterwards I have much more time. So the question for you that you can reflect on, maybe we'll come back to it near the end of the talk, is why? Why is that? Why do you get more time? Why do I seem to get more time when I meditate than if I just continued going around doing a lot of different things? So I think it's a phenomena of modern culture that has a lot of roots. There's a lot of reasons for it being there. And certainly we can point to technology as being one of them. Technology has said it's supposed to save us time. And that's been, people have been saying that for 50, 100 years, that, you know, technology was supposed to save us time. And it did in terms of some things, but then we just did more things. And so we end up filling the time with more and more and more things. And when the psyche is doing a lot of different things through the day, there's a strong tendency for many people for their psyches to get fragmented. When we just did one thing, like my grandmother, she, different days of the week were days that this is the activity she did. She had a particular day of the week where she would wash clothes. And it would take all day to wash clothes because she had this, you know, she'd do it by hand and wringers and scrub boards and all that, and that's what she did on Tuesdays or something like that. And then she had these different days where she did these different things. And now, you know, you throw the clothes in the washing machine and walk away and come back later, and you can just, it takes no time at all compared to what it used to take. And so it lends itself to kind of fragmented life. We tend to fill life with a lot of different things. And then we can point to technology, you know, like we're so connected. It used to be, still to some degree, but I suspect it's going to change. One of the main themes of a lot of American Vipassana teachers in their talks is the theme of feeling interconnected. The importance of feeling spirituality that brings you connected and drops the separation between self and other, and we feel connected to everything, to nature and to the world. And I don't think it'll be too many more years where that's the last teaching you want to hear. And how to get more connected. Because some of us are too connected. And how many cell phones and stuff, different stuff can you have? Believe it or not, maybe I should be embarrassed to tell you this, but it happened here at the center. I think maybe I was talking to Inez on the phone. Maybe you remember this? Where I told Inez, you know, I was talking to her on the phone. I said, you know, Inez, I have three phones going at the same time. I don't know how that happened, but... I think I was listening to messages on one. I don't know. Anyway, it was kind of bizarre. I usually don't have more than one phone with me. But for some reason, I had my wife's phone with me, and I had the center's phone there. And I said, this is amazing. And that was a first. But I'm supposed to be the model of someone who doesn't live that way, right? So this state of being so connected in the internet, you know, a year ago I told someone, you know, I have a long-term goal of figuring out my life And I think it's going to take a few years, a number of years, to figure out how to do this now, so I can get myself off the internet, you know, and live without it again. I think it's possible. I have this vague memory of a time. So I think it lends itself to this, you know. And I saw recently, this week, I realized something I didn't realize about the internet. Maybe that's not true for most people, but people are sending me these emails with the kind of the expectation that I'm supposed to get them right away. And because I had this meeting with someone on Friday, I had this morning of interviews that I had scheduled, but I had a 9:30 slot that was empty. And I showed up, and I was happy to have this empty slot, and so I did some other things. And wasn't available to answer the phone call. Someone was going to call me. It was a phone interview. And then I was around the phone again at 9:45, and I got this phone call. She said, "Well, where were you? I was supposed to talk to you at 9:30. And I said, "What? You know, you want the list of things?" "Oh, there was an email, and you said email was sent to you. I was going to call at 9:30. He said, "Oh, well, I guess maybe I lost that email. I didn't see it or something." And so I went home that afternoon. There was the email. She had sent it the evening before. And somehow she expected me that the fact that she sent an email the evening before, that I would have gotten it by the next morning. Now, I guess that's what you do in polite company. I guess it's, you know, it's impolite, or it's, you know, it's rude, or it's, you know, it's something wrong with me, you know, that I don't. And then I realized, it had never really dawned on me, but I think it's true. I asked my wife, "Is this true?" And she said, "I think it's true." That a lot of people have these internet connecting, you know, this service, you know, they're connected to internet, and they have how many of you have unlimited access to the internet? You can just, you know, always be plugged in. You don't have to turn on. And how many of you keep your computer on all the time? Not so many. Or most of the time. How about most of the time? And how many, when you have it on, keep it on to your internet's, like your email thing, so that you know when email comes in? Well, it's not that many. Oh, well. I'm not that far behind. But those, you know, we're kind of slow to catch on to it. In a few years, we'll be that way, you know. And so I had this idea, well, you know, I'm supposed to have it on all the time when the emails come. It's supposed to be like the phone, right? You know, you're supposed to answer right away. Anyway, my goal is to, maybe it'll take 5 or 10 years and get off that thing. And so that lends itself to kind of being then, you know, busy. We have people call us, and then they email us, and they do all these, you know, different things. And so, but then there's more to it. And that is that all these things need to be babied. At least my things need to be babied. My computer needs attention, needs to be nourished and supported and loved and, you know, in this wonderful ways to keep the programs happy and, you know, so the programs are connected to each other nicely and they talk to each other. And sometimes my programs don't talk to each other or something. Once I put an antivirus program onto my computer and the whole computer died. So I noticed a certain amount of time goes into then taking care of these things, which was supposed to save me from time, you know. And then it takes research. I find, you know, I think I should have a better cell phone plan because I think I spend too much money, but that takes time. It used to be you had a phone for 20 years and you never thought about it again. And now there are always different plans and choices. And so part of it is we have a phenomenal amount of choice. And probably there's never been a society in human history that has as much choice as we have in modern America, in modern California. And we're expected to make choices. And we're supposed to make good choices about all kinds of things people never had to think about before. And then we have maybe the legacy of part of the human potential movement that was so central to California of perfectionism, that we're supposed to be fulfilled in all these different parts of our life. And we know so much now. Information about what's good and right and everything. And so you can be perfect in so many different areas, or at least not perfect, you can at least do it right, or do it in a wholesome way, or healthy. So like food, you know, just like all the stuff we know about food and how we're supposed to be eating. And so, like, you know, how do I do this? And I better keep up and read more books about food and what food to eat and not to eat. And how, you know, and we have all these choices now around food and then exercise. We're supposed to have perfect bodies. And, you know, and at least have some semblance of exercise. The paper every few weeks says, you know, exercise is good for you. And so then, well, how do we fit exercise in and getting a good diet in? And then we're supposed to have great recreational opportunities. And because we have all these wonderful things we can do, right? And then we're supposed to have great sex because, you know, after all, you know. I don't think most people in human history thought about great sex. I'm sure they were motivated and they did it, but it wasn't, you know, the quality of it, you know, it wasn't such a high, you know, list on the priorities. They did it, you know. And so then you can read about it and find out about how to do it better. That takes time. And then, of course, then there's television. Now, I was rather embarrassed, or embarrassed, but kind of not embarrassed at all, but I was a little bit surprised. A few years ago, I was at a kind of a dinner party, and people started talking about television programs. And I got very silent. And I got quiet. You know, I kind of didn't know what they were talking about. And I realized that I haven't known really what's been on television for 30 years. And I was kind of shocked at myself. I mean, Rip Van Winkle slept for only 20 years. And then the thought was, oh my God, you know, I better not tell anyone that. And you know, if they knew that, maybe I should try to catch up. I can't catch up, but at least I can kind of be current. And that takes time. You know, but I haven't done that. And so much, you know, so many things to do, boy. And then you're supposed to meditate, right? And you've heard that meditation is supposed to be good for you, and you're supposed to, you know, and fit that in somehow. And then we've been told Americans are sleep deprived as a culture. And, you know, you're telling us I need to sleep? And that takes time. When I could be doing something else. And I'd rather, you know, sleep less and have coffee, you know, or whatever. So, some of it's a little bit legacy of this human potential movement. One of the roots is the perfectionism, having it all, which goes back, the roots of the human potential movement goes back to the romantic movement, which I talked about last week, which very simplistically put a tremendous emphasis on self-fulfillment. And so the idea of somehow having a wonderful experience, wonderful aesthetic experiences, wonderful spiritual experiences, wonderful emotional experiences, somehow being personally self-fulfilled. Most people in human history never thought about personal self-fulfillment. I had an interesting conversation with a parent in our sitting group here. We had this parent discussion group. And she said, you know, all I care about is, I don't care about whether my kids are always happy. All I care about is I raise them so when they become adults, they know how to take care of themselves in a good way. They can manage their life really well. And that was, I think that's an old-fashioned approach to raising children. I think that's how, you know, 50 years ago, probably some of you remember. I think you didn't think it, but now we have this history of culture of psychology. And parents now know so much about the psychological development of their kids. And that things are so important. And, you know, because you might mess up your kid, you know, and so you have to, so first you have to take the time to read all these books. Because now you're supposed to know about all these things. 50 years ago, people didn't read. They weren't even, there was Dr. Spock, right? And that's gotten bigger over the years, so it takes more time to read it. But you know, I think for parents, and I talk for myself also, that there's much more concern about the inner life of a child and what influences. And I've been told by the previous generation of parents that the current generation of parents are seeing much more anxious about their kids than they ever were. And partly because I think we know so much about the influences. And so that adds to time and doing. And then we have a culture which is fragmented geographically, and commuting to work and commuting the kids to school and this and that. And I mean, how many of you are you starting to get a headache from this talk? Listening to all this, you know how it is for some people. And so our society feeds us all kinds of messages. There's a culture that's this way. And so partly, you know, we're influenced very much by the environment that we're in. And it's an environment that seems to support and feed this kind of being very active, very busy. And you know, sometimes you go into some certain environments and they just encourage it. You know, you go into restaurants, sometimes the music is on loud. And you go to airports, you know, and the television is on. You go to doctors' waiting rooms and the television's on. And it kind of, I find it kind of jarring and a little bit it doesn't actually kind of. I don't feel so good actually in that kind of environment when I hear that. And part of it, I think, sometimes it makes me feel more hyped up to listen to television in a doctor's waiting room or something. And then I don't feel like I can go ask people to turn it off because people are watching it. But are we to blame our culture? Are we to blame technology? Do we blame as if out there is the reason for it? Probably, one of the more important points we need to point to, places we need to point to, for people who do mindfulness practice, who do Buddhist practice, is to point to ourselves, and to see in ourselves what is it in ourselves that is the root, the cause for maybe being overly busy or being feeling crammed in or feeling stressed about time, not having enough time. And probably one of the root causes is the very simple thing is desire, is craving, wanting to have, wanting to do, and wanting to have more and more, wanting to do a lot of different things. And part of the problem is a lot of things we want are basically healthy, good things. There are a lot of things people want that are not necessarily healthy and good. But there's nothing wrong with a lot of people's basic desires of good health and good exercise and good friendship and meditation, and a lot of things that people do are basically good. But I think a lot of the wonderful things that people do, there's too many opportunities and too many things to do. So I know some people who get overly busy because they feel that they have to be of service. They have to kind of help others. They have to be, so they volunteer in all kinds of places. And so they're kind of succumbing to the idea that our desire for service and helping others means that we're supposed to fit it into every possible corner of our life. And if we don't do it every place, then all little corners and edges, then we are somehow not the bodhisattva, not helping people. But desire, how does desire function on this? And desire can be painful, can cause suffering and pain, even when what we desire is a basically healthy thing, if it lends itself to an imbalanced life. So when I find myself feeling harried by not having enough time to do all the things I should do, then I try to sit. And when I do that, I seem to have a lot more time. And I believe one of the reasons for that is that when I sit, momentum for desiring tends to relax. And when I don't have so many desires, then my mind has more space. My mind has more time. My mind is not rushing or filling itself. And then my mind is more spacious. Then I seem to enter into what I'm doing in a much more relaxed way. And when I do things in a more relaxed way, it seems generally that I'm more productive when I'm trying to do things. Or I realize that some of the things that I thought I had to do, I don't have to do. It helps me kind of set my priorities straight and to change my priorities. I've noticed one phenomena is that when I try to do a lot of things, like I have a long list of things to do and I'm trying to do them all, and I might be maybe quite productive and get a fair amount of things done, but at some point it sets in kind of a habit formation for me, or maybe it's the wrong word, but it sets in a certain kind of momentum where when I finish my list, my mind is still looking for something to do. because I'm kind of the energy of kind of doing is there. And boy, you know, basically I was doing good, healthy things, but because of the way I was involved in it. So I have to monitor how I'm involved in things. So when I do things that I don't do things, so I'm building up this momentum or this habit of leaning forward and reaching forward. So when I do things, that it's kind of clean each time I do it. Because if it's not clean, if I'm leaning forward and grabbing and rushing and trying to do many things or trying to grab onto, if desire is operating too strongly, then there's traces that are left in my system that then have a momentum of their own that can send it and then start to carry me forward. So I have to pay attention to how I am acting on my desires, how I'm doing it, and to do it in a way that's cleaner, where I'm not leaning into the future or not rushing to do it, but to do it completely and fully as I can each time I'm doing it. But to look at our desires, to look at the whole range of our desires, one of the things I find very important for me is to look at the intentions, the priorities by which I organize my life. And there's a lot of things that I've let fall to the wayside because they were good things to do, they're healthy things to do, they were probably, in some one point of view, probably things I should be doing. But if I added that to my life, it would have been unhealthy. And so it was a trade-off between dropping doing a healthy thing or getting sick because I did a healthy thing. You know, sometimes doing one more dharma activity is undharmic. If you're just adding to this busy life and this kind of momentum forward and getting and taking and doing. So I believe that somehow, if those of us who are in this kind of, caught in this kind of phenomena of being overly busy, we have to start taking responsibility for that for ourselves. And society is not going to take responsibility. And getting things done is not a solution. I've tried for a while to get through my lists, and but you know the list. I have this amazing ability of proliferating lists, or somehow just, you know, I finally get close to the end of a list, and then I get all these phone calls, and there's more people want more things out of me, or this and that. I never seem to be able to get, you know, finish. It used to be, I remember a time when there was nothing. Someone asked me, what's on your list? And I had nothing. But, you know, it was a while ago. And so how I am in the midst of doing things then becomes very important. And then spending some wise time looking at priorities and what needs to be dropped is actually very, very important. And if we think it's only a matter of losing something, letting go, then I ask you to look more carefully, to look at what is gained by living a simpler life, by simplifying the life, giving your life more time, more space, by doing less activity. One of the things that's gained is the spiritual life itself. Because spiritual life itself, as I understand it, requires time. A spiritual life is not an efficient life. Or the way the psyche unfolds and changes and matures in the spiritual life, it's not efficient in the sense that we usually think of being productive and getting things done. How efficient is it to sit looking out the window at the clouds moving? I mean, you have this long list next to you on the table, things to do, and then you have the clouds. And which is more important? The list or the clouds? From the point of view of your psyche, for many people, for me, especially people who are busy, it's probably more important for your psyche to look at those clouds, to just sit there and do nothing. The spiritual life needs space and time for the unfolding, for the movement, for the settling, for the letting go, for the revealing of what's there. It's almost as if there's aspects inside of us that we almost yearn to touch, which are shy. And you have to be very quiet or very spacious or very, it's like an animal that's afraid of you. And you have to be kind of show that you're kind of nonviolent and kind and not threatening. And then slowly, if you just kind of sit there and wait, the animal will come to you. So aspects of inner psyche is that way too. And if we're rushing about and doing a lot, we actually squash the ability to touch into these deep parts of ourselves, which are shy. So we need to give time. And part of the reason people don't want to take the time like that, and one reason some people are really busy, is that that process of listening to those deeper voices and going deep can be uncomfortable and frightening. It isn't everything that's in there that has a whisper inside of us is beautiful. There's also our fears that are there, our angers that are there. And so part of the process of giving time, part of giving time is to let the process of these movements within us to reveal themselves and be worked through, rather than always running away from them, and that's so easy to do. A friend of mine went to her Zen teacher once and said that, talked about all the different things she does and how busy she is and how she has, you know, very, very busy life, and I guess what she said was a bit of a problem. And her teacher looked at her and said something like, you know, it's because you're lazy. And that kind of shocked her. What? I'm the last person who's lazy. You know, I'll do all these things. I'm very successful. I'm busy in my life. And she thought about it for some time afterwards. She realized she was being lazy because the hard work was to stop and look at herself. And that's what she wasn't doing. It was easier, actually, to stay busy. So to give time and space to the psyche to do something which is not of our doing. And if we think that we're always in charge and responsible, that lends itself to the idea that we have to do. But if we realize that there's an aspect of our psyche which we can't take responsibility for, except for making space for it, except making time for it, then maybe we're more willing to let go of things so we can let this deeper aspect of who we are bubble to the surface and touch into it. So it's not just a matter of losing by doing less, but it's also a matter of gaining something that can't be gained unless you give the time for it. And it's not an efficient process. It isn't that you sit down and look at the clouds and after 5 minutes, you know, it's not happening yet, you know. You might need to look at the clouds for 2 years before something very, very precious arises. But who's going to sit looking at clouds for 2 years? I've known people who've gone on meditation retreats of 7 days, of 10 days, and cried the whole time. And they felt, they were convinced, that, afterwards in retrospect, that was what they needed to do. And that was the place they were able to do that, to give themselves that kind of time. Because the psyche needed that level of purifying or purging itself, of just crying and crying and crying. But, you know, maybe, you know, that doesn't seem very efficient. You know, maybe there's faster ways of doing it. You know, they have now fast therapy. You know, Kaiser will only give you 3 sessions or something. So, there's a phenomenon called short-term therapy. And who has time anymore for, you know, therapy, the ways to do it every week? I mean, gee, for an hour? I mean, that's... So 10-minute sessions are probably really good for all of us. But I think in certain parts of even therapy, sometimes it takes a long time. You need a lot of time. And if you're trying to be efficient about it, it doesn't work. So to look at our priorities, to change those, to look at our desires, to understand the nature of our desires and take responsibility, learn how to let go of desires. I think learning how to let go of desires is one of the great skills of being a human being. So that's basically the things I had in mind to say. But I did want to read a little bit from the Metta Sutta. And it starts off at the beginning saying, to reach the state of peace. And a lot of people want peace. But no one, a lot of people want it, but don't actually live as if they really want it. They say they want it, but they don't really want it. Because peace is not... All these things... Peace is like nothing. And, you know, it's not having a better job. It's not having a better relationship. It's not having a better bank account. It's not having a better recreational opportunity. It's not having better sex. It's not having better food or better health. It's all these things that we think we need to have are not there in peace. So we can't chase after it the same way. And you can't buy it. So... But anyway, to reach the state of peace, then the Metta Sutta goes in and gives a whole bunch of qualities that a person needs to cultivate or develop in order to touch into some ability, some deep psychic peace or spiritual peace. One should be upright, straightforward, easy to speak to, gentle and not proud, contented and easily supported. And this next line is the reason I'm reading this. Living lightly and with few duties, wise and with senses calm, not arrogant and without greed for supporters. Living lightly and with few duties. The Buddhist monastics in the Theravadan tradition talk about some of the hindrances to that monastic life. And one of the hindrances to monastic life is having too many projects. And if we can extrapolate from that, that the spiritual life is hindered by having too many projects. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean all this, that you need to do anything less. And I'll tell you a little secret, which is very dangerous, because probably if most of you try this, think you can get away with it. You can keep doing all that you're doing and get away with it. I mean, that's kind of the little secret I'm going to tell you. You think you can get away with it and then you stay busy. In Zen, there's a little teaching called about discovering the one who's not busy. And one of the ways that's understood is that that part of the mind which is unmoving, which is rest, which is non-reactive, in the midst of activity. So if you can be the one who's not busy in the midst of activity, then you can keep doing everything that you're doing. And that happens. You can do that. But don't try to use this as an easy out. Because it's easy to fool yourself, that thinking that you're managing to do it. The inner life has a tremendous need for time and space. And one of the essential qualities of spirituality, of the one who doesn't move, the one who's not busy, is a sense of the timelessness that's always here. So to know that things are timeless, to have a sense of it being timeless, this moment, is not possible if time is an oppression, if time is a preoccupation, if time is something to be used efficiently and get through. But to go through your life with some sense of the timeless, or to have periodic times where you have some contact with something that resembles a timeless experience, timeless reality, timeless present. That's what I think nourishes the roots of our being, is my sense. So I talked much longer than I wanted to, because I was hoping to hear a little bit from some of you, what your thoughts about this are. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, what came to mind to me was the fact that, like, the Jewish religion is my background. There's a day of rest. And it was just something that came to mind as I was listening to the text of the day, supposedly. Now, people study and they read the Bible or whatever, but it's kind of a day to kind of not do your normal activities. I don't know if you can comment that. What you know about any other spiritual paths? Or
I think it's a very wise thing. I like to call it sacred leisure. Having time for sacred leisure, Sabbath. I also like the fact that the word recreation means to recreate. And so I think we've lost sight of that in some ways. That at least spiritual recreation is those activities that allow us to recreate or touch into that which is really creative. In the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, there's what's called the observance days. And the observance days are usually, for lay people, the new moon and the full moon days. And then in Thailand, for example, that's a day to go and spend the day in the monastery, or spend the day kind of engaged in kind of religious, kind of a spiritual context for your day. And so every 2 weeks, there's this kind of 14 days, there's this kind of day that's spent that way. In Judeo-Christian traditions, it's every 7 days. And when I was in the Zen monasteries, they were on a different week. They were in the 5-day week. So there were 4 days of work and then 1 day of rest. And then 4 days of work. So they had a different, you know. But even the Zen monasteries, you had to have days off, right? You think, spiritual people wouldn't need it, right? living in a monastery, but then the psyche needs it. It's a very important aspect of this. So I strongly recommend to people to have that time of not always working, and I try to do that. And a little bit, it's built in for me sometimes with a family, because family has requirements that sometimes are quite nice, and it's kind of nice that something that's a requirement also is, I feel, is very nourishing to be. And then I try to take time during the week the best I can, and for various things. So I do it more in chunks rather than whole days. Yeah.
So I like to try to find time in a great practice while I'm at work, which sounds almost impossible, but it's actually not for those of us who work in offices and meetings and phone calls and the internet and all of those pieces. So I found that in every day there are plenty of times that you wouldn't think that you could take time out. And it's the time when you're walking to your office. It's the time when you're walking down the hall to go to the bathroom. It's eating lunch, which so many people do at their desk. You just stop eating lunch at your desk and go someplace else. Just those little moments of time when you stop thinking on the way to a meeting about what's going to go on in the meeting. Only think about where you are at that moment. And be in that moment, however long it takes to walk down the hall. It's amazingly refreshing throughout the day. There's time to find.
Your talk was very timely for me because my computer crashed 4 weeks ago and I lost everything. And when I found out I lost everything a day later, I was, of course, like, oh my gosh, where am I going to find all this? And what happened is that for 3 weeks I had the best life ever. I didn't have a computer. And so what I did was I knew I would be getting another one. So I would go to the library. And once a week, out of the 3 weeks, I didn't have a computer, and I'd log on, look at all my mail, of which 50% needed to be deleted anyway, and I would answer things from the library. And I love my library anyway in Menlo Park, but particularly loved it in this instance. So I did have to get a computer anyway, and I got my first laptop ever. So, but I'm really trying to only look at it once a day. I'm going to try that. So, and then when I heard you about the cell phones, I'm resisting a cell phone. I don't own a cell phone. I don't want a cell phone. The only problem is whenever I go somewhere and I get lost or I'm running late, it's often hard to find a payphone now. It really is. So I'm driving all around looking for a payphone, and so that's the only frustration. But I don't really miss having people call me on a phone. I just love the quiet in my car. And I also find that when I have that need to be quiet and I'm running around and doing things, working, whatever, sometimes I just sit and have chai tea or coffee or whatever, and it allows me to come down and be quiet and do nothing but sit and have a cup of tea or coffee by myself. And so that, and it doesn't take a lot of time to do that, but I feel so refreshed afterwards. It's my time to meditate, only enjoying a little.
Yeah.
So it was very timely, and thank you.
I think it's very interesting around cell phones is that there were times in the past, the people who now have cell phones, times in the past that, or they say, cell phones allows us to use up time that other times would have been not used for much more anything. Even just driving. Driving sometimes can be a rejuvenating activity for some people. Just you drive quietly and easily with nothing radio on. But now, you know, you can have a headset and be talking and the phone, or you can be walking down the street and talk on the phone, and then you can do all kinds of things. And now we have cordless phones, so you can even go to the bathroom when you're on the phone. You try to do it quietly because you don't want the person to know. But it used to be bathroom was, you know, much more quiet. I don't do that. Though I've thought of it. That's for sure. And I haven't. Yes.
You don't have to answer the phone. One of the things that I've observed is if a lot of people, if they're involved in some activity, they won't allow themselves to be interrupted, but they will answer the phone, which I find to be kind of an anathema. And I've discovered that if you don't answer the phone, nothing happens. It's more likely that something will happen if you do answer the phone.
One of the exquisite things is the phone rings and you don't answer it, and the person hangs up. That's great. Because then you can say, well, I guess it wasn't important.
There aren't that many things that we will interrupt whatever it is we are doing for, except the phone.
Yeah.
Don't answer the phone and turn off your answering machine.
One of the things, you know, in a relationship, you know, if I don't want to talk, you know, he might still want to pick up the phone. And it took me a while, you know, to, you know, because sometimes I just don't want to talk. So my friends actually know that it's okay. You know, he'll say, oh, she doesn't want to talk. And that's good enough. You know, I used to kind of make excuses and stuff a lot, but people know.
Nice. So it's time. So I hope this has been useful. And for those of you who this is not useful, you can sympathize.